Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Barling and Barrett. My name is Simon Barrett, and this week I'm joined by author, activist, and bar owner, Sam Murphy. Sam, welcome to the program.
Happy New Year, Simon, and I look forward to a great show, and thank you for having me on.
Yeah, I'm sorry, but this week we're back to politics and crime. But last week was fun. I do hope you enjoyed a little excursion into some music.
I really enjoyed it, and your guest was fabulous and very talented. And I wish him the best of luck in his endeavors. And the music you played was really good. It was a nice and relaxing way to end the old year and begin the new year with that nice music you played.
Also joining us on the panel is well-known LA attorney Peter Haven. Peter, welcome.
Oh, it's good to be back. Happy New Year to everyone. Hope everybody had a safe and happy holidays.
Right, and I trust the same for you. In fact, just for our listeners, before we came on air, I was talking to Peter, and it turns out he's a big Doctor Who fan. Hey, way to go, Peter.
I'm sure everybody's going, Doctor Who?
Right. that's the story for another program.
That's a good show. I like watching it.
Indeed. And last but by no means least, the always colorful owner of Sunset Protection, John Perry. John, welcome.
Happy New Year, Simon. Do you care to share any of your resolutions with us?
No. All right. Before we get into the serious stuff, I was doing some research online this morning, and how I stumbled across this, I do not know, but I was looking for a victim on the panel that liked sushi, and I asked John his view on sushi, and his response was, "I like my food cooked."
Or processed.
Or processed. However, I do believe that, Peter, you're a bit of a sushi fan.
Well, I definitely like it when it's offered. I don't go out of my way to get it, but I do love a good sushi place as much as the next guy. I love it.
Oh, okay. Well, this morning I stumbled across what has to be the strange story of the week. A couple of days ago, the first tuna auction of the year was held in Japan.
You know, I'm glad you mentioned that, because I read about that, and it is astounding what those tuna go for.
Right. The big winner, shall we say, was a 489-pound tuna that sold at auction. Forget this. $1.76 million.
Yeah, it's amazing. Most people think of tuna as just little Charlie tuna swimming around in the ocean, but the big tuna that they fish after are giants. They're 8 or 9 feet long, and if they catch them at the right season, at the right time, they go to auction at a special market in I think it's in Tokyo, and they fetch that kind of money. And there was a great story a while ago about a guy who caught a record-breaking tuna about 2 or 3 months ago, and he couldn't take it to auction because he caught it out of season. He had to let it go, and it was worth about $1 million, and he just had to turn it back in the ocean. It was pretty funny.
Okay, well, the story went on to claim that out of this huge tuna, there was probably 10,000 pieces of sushi slices to be had. Now, I'm not great at math, but that looks like it's about $175, you know, per very thin slice of sushi.
Well, I'll give you that. It doesn't the math doesn't seem to add up, but I suspect there's a lot more than 10,000 servings of sushi in there. Those are monster fish.
Right. I mean, and that's not even figuring in you know, the cost of the sticky rice.
Yeah, well, you know, food markup is an interesting thing at a restaurant. You know, when you order a plate of food, it could cost, you know, about $1 to prepare, but it's about 10 times the markup. So I imagine it's the same thing with sushi.
Well, okay, Sam, you're in the business.
Not in the sushi business.
Well, no, but I mean the food and beverage business.
Yes.
I was always... told that there's this thing called the rule of threes. You know, it basically, if you buy something for $1, you want to sell it for $3. You know, cover your costs. Am I somewhere close?
You're very close. That's in a normal market. The market has not been normal since 2008, since the crash that continues to go on, and I, you know, now in certain areas, the rule of three is sometimes the rule of 15, like Manhattan and probably Tarzana, probably Southern California and all those wonderful places, Paris and all those places are more than the rule of three. We've been lucky to get the rule of 1.5, basically to get the had to keep prices down, even though prices have been going up for many reasons, just to keep people coming through the door. If you drive by the two busiest restaurants in my county, owned by the same company, I forget who owns them, but the two franchises are Red Lobster and Olive Garden, and they have nothing but all you can eat XYZ for $9.99, like all you can eat coconut shrimp for $9.99. I don't think they're doing rules of three there. They're just getting nuts. God knows what's in this one. I think, as Manny once said, Red Lobster should never Red Lobster as a not the motto, their insignia, it should be a skull and crossbones. And right, you have to eat there. But no, in some of those places it's not. I think, you know, in a normal bar, restaurant, business, anywhere, without the not more tourist traps, this or that, the rule of three is a great rule if you can do it. We have not been able to, unfortunately, and better cut back to keep people coming in the doors because of the competition.
Well, going with the rule of three, a piece of this tuna, you know, on your plate is going to put you back about $500 or $600.
Go ahead, Sam. You know more about this stuff than I do.
No, I was just going to say, as far as I never knew tunas were that big. When you were just talking about it and I read a little about it, I was like, you know, who would spend that type of money on a tuna? But obviously, as you said, there's a lot of slices in it, and it's got to be like a Nobu, or the guy who owns Nobu of Tokyo, or Nobu of whatnot, because he'll be able to get super duper prices out of that to justify paying $1.7 million for that. I mean, as tough as the market is, and you know, for me on wings and this and that, and other people going to it, there are high end places that are just having, you know, doing wonderful. They're doing gangbusters. The high end area where I live now is just kind of revival of the downtown area with lots of tax dollars and whatnot to prop up these bars and restaurants to make it look like it's a downtown in Youngstown. And they charge, I'm amazed, I get $4 for a shot of Crown Royale, which is as high as you can get in a blue-collar bar around. And downtown, that same shot's getting $12. So, I mean, it all depends where you're located at.
I don't think the I mean, first of all, you know, my understanding is that this market that they auction these off, it's in Tokyo, and gosh knows what the prices of dinners are in Tokyo. But a lot of the money, as I understand it, Sam, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but a lot of the money that's made at restaurants is not just, you know, off the plate of fish. You know, you've got your beverages and your alcohol, and I understand there's a big markup there, and everybody orders all kinds of whatnot. I don't know what, you know, I presume these people know why they're spending $1 million on a giant tuna. I think I don't think they'd spend that kind of money unless they were pretty sure they were going to get a return on it. You know, at movie theaters, you know how movie theaters make all their money?
Concessions.
They don't make hardly anything off the tickets, but, you know, when they charge you $8 for a tub of popcorn that costs them gosh knows what, that's where they make all their money. You know, similar returns to scale, I imagine, in other places.
Okay. It all depends on doing where the selling's taking place, as you said. Like at a sporting event, the markup is incredible.
I know.
I think we've all
it's unbelievable.
Got, you know, all that. It's just amazing. You're right. I think, like you said, it's a movie theater. So I really believe it all depends where you're at. I mean, you can go find in Manhattan, you know, when my kids who lived there, when the stock market crashed in 2008, it was amazing that I would literally be able to go to a four-star restaurant in Manhattan around Wall Street. And they were throwing themselves at you to come into the restaurant and bar, and the prices were dirt cheap. Well, 4 years later, whatever, 5 years later, those type of deals don't exist anymore. So I've always said that.
Okay, folks, we haven't even started the program.
Oh, are you kidding me? We're just in the miso soup phase of the program.
Oh, right.
We've begun.
But,
I'm going to have some sake by the time this is over.
Right. But
you're the one who started
it, Simon. we already have a caller on the line.
If we've got a fish on the line, let's bring it in.
Okay, well, here we go. Caller from area code 718. What's your name and what's your question for us?
Jay, I don't have a question, but I definitely would like to comment on that. They definitely need to do some type of regulation on how these businesses are quadrupling and you know, enormously making money off a product, you know, where they're ripping off, you know, the person. And, you know, it's crazy because, you know, you find out that the reason why a lot of these are or why we have these problems, these financial problems or this financial crisis is because all the people that are getting robbed, you know, and the ones, again, that's gaining the money through, you know, these large corporations. And it's not about profiting. I mean, you got to make a profit, but to you know, quadruple, this is almost like selling drugs, you know?
Okay.
I agree.
Jay, you make a good point, and, you know, stay on the line. Let's move on to the I can't resist saying meat and potatoes of the program. Okay, this past week we saw the fiscal cliff. I won't say it's avoided, but it's delayed. Yet no one seems to be really, really happy about it. John, do you have any comments?
Real quick, Simon, just on the tuna fish, I'd like to give a plug to my favorite, Bumblebee. And Al Gore would be wise to invest that $100 million he made from selling his network to Al Jazeera in a tuna farm. As far as the fiscal cliff, I think Peter had it right. There was an 11th hour agreement, which pretty much we all saw was going to happen anyway. And I'm sure the next emergency will be in a couple months, and it's just people have to be kept in a constant state of panic and look to our leaders to solve all our problems.
Okay. To me, and I hate to use the term, but all they've done is kick the stinking can down the road.
Oh, Simon, I wanted to say real quick, too, I spent the holidays productively in honor of Jay and educated myself.
Uh-oh. Okay, tell us more.
That's about it, Simon. I'll defer the rest of my time to the honorable gentleman from Ohio.
How dare you insult me, call me a member of Congress.
Hey, out, Sammy.
Happy New Year to you, John. How are you?
Same to you, bro. Good to speak to you.
That's good. You too, Peter. You too, Simon. Happy New Year.
Likewise.
Well, you know, when we're talking about the tuna, I always got to say, Bill Parcells got a job, the real big tuna.
He's the biggest.
He's the biggest one. You know, I think we all predicted, in one way or another, that this would basically be a, as you said, Simon, the proverbial can kicked down the road, put it off, such a, you know, was, they'd make the little deals and go on. I was amazed. And Simon, we emailed each other a couple times off it, and a lot of other people I seem to be talking about it, was all the earmarks and pork barreling that came with this, quote, avoiding the fiscal cliff. And it caught me by surprise because I didn't think that would even be in there. You know, this is a special deal that had to get done to calm the markets and get things rolling, yet all it turned out to be was another, you know, the carrot and the stick for the members of Congress to be bought and sold, and the American people got stuck with a bill of goods. And as John pointed out, 2 months down the road, we're going to be back at this debt ceiling problem again, if it is a problem. And
right.
That's sad, especially when you looked at the, you know, the amounts of earmarks that were shoved in this bill and have been shoved down our throats continually.
Actually, the earmarks bother me a great deal. But the earmarks in the Hurricane Sandy relief bill bother me even more.
They should. You know, that's sad, isn't it? That we, you know, and then so if you're a member of, correct me if I'm wrong, you're a good member of Congress, I don't know if there's that many, you realize that we got to get flood insurance aid to these people destroyed in from Hurricane Sandy. You want to see direct aid go to them just for that. Yet all your colleagues shove all these earmarks into this bill so they can take care of their tech projects. And, you know, it really becomes a cluster, you know what, for the taxpayers. And I get, and then the, so a good citizen, a good member of Congress stands up and says, no, it's the media and the colleagues. Make it look like this person's holding up aid for people really need it. You know, I mean, you're damned if you do and damned if you don't. And so you can almost not even vote against these things because, you know, you end up being vilified and straight on out of the Congress.
I don't know who sponsored this little bit of pork. But, John, were you aware that the Hurricane Sandy relief bill contained $70 million worth of tax exemptions for NASCAR? I mean, what the hell's that got to do with Hurricane Sandy?
Of course I was, Simon. Let me enlighten you. I'm being a viewer of Fox News. I'm aware of everything. It was Harry Reid who put the bill together, and I'm sure he got together with all his special interest groups. And, Simon, I think you'll know who said, never squander an opportunity to exploit an emergency. That's all they're doing. It's situation normal. Nothing's going to change.
But, you know, it isn't, this has to be a contributing factor
as to why the country is in such dire straits.
Well, I blame Nevada for giving us Harry Reid.
Okay. Another earmark was, I think it's $170 million to Alaskan fisheries. Now,
I saw that. Maybe they're tuna farm startups. And if we can sell tuna for $1 million a pop, I'd be for that.
Well, that's salmon fishing country up there.
But John, being serious for a moment, Alaska is pretty much a red state. So how do you explain that particular?
Well, they do have a Democratic senator from Alaska now. I forget his name, but I'm sure that had a part in it.
But doesn't it bother you that, you know, that there's a bill specifically aimed at, a hurricane relief program, and there's all this crap in there?
Well, Simon, let me put it like this. A lot of things bother me, like your complete ignorance on the subject matter doesn't prevent you from offering an opinion, but I would never want to suppress that because it's so entertaining.
Now, you're just using you in the general sense. You're not referring to Simon per se, right?
Oh, I'm just saying that's just something we have to live with. We voted for these clowns, and now we're going to get it good and hard. So get
up to insult the clowns.
But there's a whole new act of clowns in Congress.
When I saw about this stuff, Hollywood gives a lot of money to presidential campaigns. I thought that all these, most of them did. The high profile George Clooney would have a big fundraiser for Obama, or we thought Kid Rock would get Romney, whatever, I was shocked to find out how much money they give in order to get. And what they got in the fiscal cliff, Mark, was pathetic. That $430 billion in tax breaks for any television show or movie that's produced in the 48 states, not Hawaii or not Alaska. So if you produce a movie or a television show, the first $15 million of your production cost is tax-free. So that comes to like $450 billion for this year that's coming around. And I'm thinking, and then there's $70 billion for NASCAR, $150 billion for Bacardi, with the whole rum deal going between the rum war between Virgin Islands and Puerto Rico. And I'm thinking, why not take that money and just give $100,000 to every American family? I mean, why bail out all these people? Why not just give $100,000 to every family? If you're in the sport of giving,
right.
And that's what's going on here.
Peter, what are your thoughts on these earmarks, this pork that we're seeing?
I agree with what everyone has said. It's an unfortunate side effect of the democratic political process that our elected representatives, by the operation of our constitutional government, they're held accountable to their constituents. And they're also at the mercy of powerful lobbying groups. And they are sensitive to the needs of the various constituencies that are responsible for keeping them in their job. And it's just an unfortunate aspect of a democracy. They answer to their constituencies when they're not otherwise answering to their own self-interests. And, having been up there on the Hill, you got 435 people in the House, you got 100 people in the Senate, and they all have their own needs, wants, and desires, and they're all based upon basically getting reelected and also looking out for their own economic self-interest. And at the end of the day, when it comes time to do a compromise on a so-called crisis piece of legislation like this, they all get together and they all say, well, you know, you want my vote. Here's what I want in return, and I got to have it or you ain't going to get my vote. And there's just a lot of handshake agreements and scratch my back, I'll scratch yours. We're all here trying to maintain our seats. We're all here trying to get reelected. We're all here answering to our powerful constituents and the screaming needs that are apparent of our voting populace. And this stuff just happens over and over and over and over again. And the only good thing that can be said about it, the only good thing in my opinion, is that whenever there's a real crisis, they get together and they try to address it, but you know, they still never separate themselves from their various self-interests. And this is just an inherent part of the democratic government we have. I don't know what else to say about it. It's sad but true.
Okay, I'm going to play devil's advocate just for a moment. Sam brought up the tax credits that are being given to Hollywood. I watched a rather interesting news segment on that particular subject, and the bottom line is, you know, one man's pork is another man's job. The Hollywood industry is huge and very profitable, but over recent years, there's been move to shoot in Canada, even in Europe,
Eastern Europe in particular.
Eastern Europe in particular. Now, without those tax credits, how many jobs would be lost? And we're not talking about, you know, studio executives. We're talking about the grunts, you know, the people that you know, are carpenters, electricians, etc. You know, so is it really pork, or is it some kind of economic incentive?
I'm sure when it's being pitched, I'm sure when they're asking for it, it's not pork at all. It's all economic incentives. We're trying to help out the key grip. We're trying to help out the craft food services guy and all the assistants. I mean, if any of you have ever been on a movie set or been anywhere near that kind of thing, it is a small army. It is a small army, and they roll in like the military. They roll in with trucks. They establish base camp. They hit HQ. And for every person who's on screen, there's probably a dozen who are off screen scurrying about doing tons and tons and tons of jobs. It's always amazing to me every time I see it. So I'm sure when it's being pitched as, well, we're trying to help all these people. But somehow, in my cynical mind, I doubt the trickle-down effect in the end. But maybe I'm wrong. Hopefully I'm wrong. Hopefully it's helping, you know, the working people and not helping others. But I fear the worst.
And John, you hover on the fringes of the rich and famous.
Yeah, I know Manny.
Need we say more?
What's your view on this? You know, tax credit. Is it an economic incentive, or is it just plain pork?
Well, just amplifying what Peter said, the most important part of a movie set is the honey wagon. It can make or break.
An army moves on its stomach.
That's right, and it's much appreciated. I believe this, Simon. Like, freedom, capitalism, to me, is an indivisible word, and it shouldn't be applied to some and not others. I don't want to see special dispensations to Hollywood or any other corporate entity or business. It should be applied across the board, because what works for one is going to work for another, and I'm just struck by the hypocrisy that they're out there calling for higher taxes and whatnot, and first opportunity, they ship production off to Canada. And I don't like the hypocrisy of it. I want people to make money, and I want the workers to get compensated. I don't think the actors should make $20 million when people are making $30 an hour driving the trucks.
I agree.
But, and also, there is a lot of resentment among the working people in Hollywood toward the actors, but they won't come out and say it because they'll lose their job. But they're
right
out there constantly saying they want to pay their fair share, they want their taxes raised, and then they take advantage of every possible loophole that the rest of us have no opportunity to exploit. And that's what bothers me. Apply it across the board. Encourage business in this country, whether it be movies, industry, oil, whatever it is.
I'm going to bounce this to Sam. Sam, earlier this week, you sent me an interesting and very cryptic email. And it concerned the fiscal cliff and how it had been avoided, so there's no tax increases. But that's not quite the story, is it?
No, not at all. On Friday, my employees all got their paychecks, and they all came to me, and they said, hey, how come I'm getting a little less money in my paychecks? Are you taking more? What happened? I said, you're actually getting 2.5% less, and I'm getting 5% more. And they go, you are? And I said, I'm getting 5% more that I have to give back to the government because your payroll taxes were cut by the Democrats and Republicans. And if you really want to know why, you need to call the White House and ask Obama that when did it come out a bartender at those places was making $450,000 a year. But those are the ones whose taxes went up. That's what they said. And he was going to protect the middle class. But lo and behold, the Republicans and Democrats on Monday night, no one spoke for us. Nobody was there to help us keep our little 2.5% payroll tax cut. And because we don't have the lobbying power that Hollywood or Bacardi Rum or NASCAR has. And they, so they got the cut. Everyone who gets paid weekly by somebody else or, saw the taxes go up after January, after Tuesday.
I'm not trying to pry here and ask for personal information. Presumably you pay your staff weekly. What was the average hit? Like 50 cents?
No. The average hit probably was 10 to 15 bucks a week. So
wow.
Add that by four and a half in a month. And for some of my employees, that's a couple tanks of gasoline. For other people might laugh at that and scoff at it, but it is what it is. For my wife and I, who are employees of came to about $1,200 a month, every little bit helps. Now, granted, we get this. We're going to basically the arguments that the pro big government status quo SOBs will give you is it doesn't matter. You're going to get it back anyway. Now they're taking more out. You'll get more back with your refund. And I've always been stop taking my money out because it's my money to operate the government. Why do you need it? I've always been a big believer that there should be no money being. People should have to voluntarily send in their taxes. They shouldn't have to be taken out by the government. It shouldn't be taken out by the employers. And we'd have a lot smarter, we'd have a lot better citizenry if every citizen had to pay their own taxes. Because most people they don't see it, and they go, I get this refund back. Look, a refund back, it's your money. The government's been stealing your money every week and using it to do all sorts of goofy things with. And then they send you a check back, and everyone's happy. And you never can understand that.
Again, I'm not trying to pry, but obviously there is cost associated with processing payroll because of all of these complex tax situations, and that must annoy you. You know, you can't say to someone, "Yeah, sure, you can wash plates. I'll pay you X amount of dollars per hour, and pay them." No, you've got to be on the nut to, be responsible for extracting their taxes, because if you don't, you'll be in trouble.
Oh, no question. I don't know how anybody, any small business of even five people, could even doing this all themselves. They would use so much time, energy, and effort, and patience, and that they would. With them, I'm lucky. I as a lot of other places, too, small businesses. I belong to. I have ADP to my payroll, and it's a lot easier once it's set up. It's a lot easier. The automatic pay increases or whatnot go in, the changes, and it's done. And the one reason, and to be honest with you, the reason I did is I didn't want to have any problems, and I never wanted the IRS knocking at my door saying you forgot to put your payroll taxes in your account for us to suck it out. So you forgot to send in your little form with the check, because small businesses who the first thing they try to do is they go, well, you know what? I'll take the money out of my employees' checks, but I ain't going to put it into the government in order to keep their heads above water. And they stop paying on the taxes and this and that, thinking eventually they'll catch up. And once you do that, you're as good as dead in business, and they come flying in. I never wanted to be in that position, so I set it up with ADP 10 years ago, and my money just sucked out of my account, and I never have to deal with worrying about the IRS or government compliance with the payroll taxes and wages and all that sort of thing. And I urge any small business to do that, because they don't charge that much money. So the work that they do, and the W-2s, and the 1099s, and the unemployment taxes, and the workman's compensation tax, all the headaches that they do for me and what they charge me, it's one of the better deals I do get as a small businessman.
John, I'm going to aim at you. You're also a small businessman. Even though I've seen your picture, you're quite a large businessman.
It's my diet, Simon.
But that's got nothing to do with it. In my mind, the problem is that the whole tax deal is so complicated that no small business like Sam's, could possibly deal with it. But the solution, at least in my mind, would be to simplify the whole process. In fact, get rid of income tax and go with a straight value-added tax. What do you think of those potatoes?
I'm really surprised, Simon. That's the most regressive tax there is. I don't mind some income tax. Sam is exactly right about the necessity of having a payroll company do your paperwork, because as businesses, we're put in the role of tax collector. And I'm sure Sam, like I do, get garnishments, meaning we're responsible for taking employees' wages out and paying it to the IRS. And there's just so much paperwork involved, people don't even realize. But I think one of the bigger lobbyist groups are accountants and attorneys, and they'd all be out of work if we didn't have this system. So, Simon, I think there has to be some kind of balance. I think a straight consumer tax on goods and services would be a little too regressive, meaning unfair to the poor. But I'm certainly in favor of some combination. I don't know exactly what it is. Herman Cain had the 999 plan. I thought that was a good start. But,
oh, no. That's how many women he was with, right? 999?
No, that was Clinton.
Oh.
But he only got caught once.
Sorry. I know, but on the subject of loopholes and what we're talking about with earmarks and payroll things, Simon, I agree with John. Value-added tax is really regressive, as are sales taxes. A lot of people don't realize that. I'm for the simple, what Steve Forbes wanted 20 years ago, the damn flat tax. Close all loopholes so you wouldn't have these lobbyists, as Peter pointed out, buying and selling our politicians, getting whatever they wanted, because as Peter said, you know, hey, listen, I'll vote for yours. You scratch my back, I'll scratch your back. Our constituents be damned. It's all about us. And we get rid of all that. And it would be very simple, you know, here's what you make, mail it in. I think he wanted a 15% one. And that's it. And we have to shrink the size of the government at all levels. I mean, all our tax, you know, and I'm tired of this phrase, fair share. You know, people saying pay our fair shares. Whatever we make, whatever we generate, we are paying our fair share. Because please take into consideration income tax, state income tax, county income tax, local income taxes, property taxes, excise taxes on your cell phone, tax on your landlines, a tax on your gas, your sales taxes. I bet you people are paying 60% to 70% of what they make to keep federal, state, county, and local governments afloat. It's just getting worse, because they keep coming up with more fees and more ways to stick it to us. And it's got to stop. It's got to stop. And in the next 90 days, capitalism versus socialism, is last battle is up, and something's got to give.
Okay, and at least in my simplistic mind, what has to give is the size of government and the services they provide. But how do you achieve that? There's a deathly silence.
Well, wait a minute. You're talking like a story. I don't mind. I realize, and I think John and Peter does too, and I know you do, Simon, and most of the listening audience, that we have to pay some taxes. I don't have a problem with that. I don't like the return on investment I'm getting from the money I pay out in taxes. My roads are in worse shape. I pay more money for tax on gasoline taxes. We have snow. The plowing's gotten worse. To go on and on. The benefits that government's supposed to provide, your fire, EMS, this, that, doing roads, infrastructure, the bridges are falling down. You name it, it's happening. But yet, I'm building hospitals in Afghanistan. I'm building hospitals in Iraq. I'm building roads, somewhere else. And then the amount of money that our tax dollars go, and that's why they got to keep taking it from us and calling it something else, that pays for unlimited health care and pensions for these politicians and the bureaucrats and everything else, it's got to stop. It's got to stop because we can't afford it anymore. And people don't realize that, you know, look, and last August, when we talked about this, when Boehner and Obama butted heads, but they did raise the debt $2 trillion. It went from 14 to 16.7 trillion. From August to December 31st of this last year, the Obama administration and our Congress pissed out $2.7 trillion. Where's that money going to? And how is it benefiting the American people? It's only benefiting a very few amount of people, considering we're a nation of 300 million. And now, back in February, he wants $4 trillion. Where's the money going to, and what's the return for all of the Americans, not just a select few, all Americans? If someone can explain that to me, I'd be a very happy person.
I think you and approximately 350 million other citizens.
I mean, where's the money go? I mean,
it's going to the banks. That's where the money, Bernanke's doing basically a wire transfer, $40 billion a month to the banks. Or is it $400 billion? I don't even know now.
Right. And that's in order to keep interest rates low, just, because if the interest rates go up, Weimar Republic.
Yeah, it's going into their treasure chest, and he's hoping they're going to lend it out.
Right.
That's where it's going.
Yeah, but it's also going to these giant sacred cows of defense spending, big government, entitlements and whatnot that are not helping. I mean, look, I'm a libertarian. Talk about cutting social programs, you better start with the number one social program for corporate welfare is the defense industry. And that has to be sliced and diced. Yeah, they don't want to be sliced and diced.
And we're operating in a vacuum. Harry Reid hasn't passed a budget in 4 years. We'll never know where the money's going. And until there's a balanced budget amendment, we will never see the bottom line. They've been operating on continuing resolutions. Every time they need more money, they just extend the debt limit, and they don't even have a budget.
Yeah, but when they do that, though, what we learn about that, when they kick the can down the road, as Simon has pointed out, 435 members of Congress all get another $100 million for their pet project. Go to opensecrets.org, and you'll be disgusted at the amount of money that is earmarked for all these congressmen, Republicans and Democrats, some of them big names, some of them people you never heard of. And while this money gets kicked back to the communities, but who does it benefit? Because it's certainly not benefiting, as Simon said, 350 million Americans. It's only benefiting a very small amount of people, and it's got to stop. And that's what's going to happen in the end of February. If they don't kick the can down the road, which I think they will, but if they don't, I mean, you're talking, this is capitalism versus socialism coming, right? It's toe-to-toe now. We're going to increase the debt limit and continue to come up with program after program after program that's not accountable to anybody but the people coming up with it and the people that have been employed by it, because it's definitely not benefiting people. I don't know if you guys saw the New York Times and the New York Times, New York Post, believe it or not, and all the New York newspapers did this open records request. People don't get a check anymore. They get a credit card or a debit card or an EBT card. Is that what it's called? Those that are on Social Security and stuff, or unemployment benefits in New York, they tracked where these payments were going. And 40% of the payments in New York were going, guess where the cards were being used at, gentlemen?
Convenience stores, liquor stores.
Not convenience. How about liquor stores? How about high-class strip joints? How about Starbucks? How about, you know, to go on and on and on? You know, I mean, but most of them were at strip clubs. And as you said, Simon, convenience stores to buy booze when it is illegal to use that money to do that in the first place. It's supposed to, you know, so that money's not even going to where it's supposed to go. And the abuse, the waste, the this, the that, no one does anything about it.
Well, Sam, they are returning some of it because I'm sure they can buy lotto tickets there.
Yeah, I'm sure they can too. But, you know, who's guilty of that? The whole idea of it was to track it. Smart idea. Well, now they're tracking it, but yet no one's doing anything. Now they're not reforming it. Why aren't they going to reform it? Because why should they? As Peter pointed out, they'll all get reelected. The majority of them all get reelected. The lobbyists come down, give them all sorts of money, make sure that they do this, and this. Also, there's some bad press for them, or bad press for the program for 1 or 2 days. And the majority of American people want to find out who's Kim Kardashian's baby's father. Right?
Okay. Peter, you've been very, very quiet, and I know you love to think and contemplate. I mean,
sometimes I sit and think, and sometimes I just sit. you know, asking where the money goes is like asking where the rain goes. You know, it goes everywhere. Good luck tracing that. Some people have catch pools and they manage to catch a lot of that rain. And some people, if they're lucky, it waters their potted plants, and that's about it. To me, you know, you have to hire an accounting firm to figure out where all that stuff goes, and the results would vary depending upon who your accounting firm was and how much you paid them. So. I don't know what to tell you in response to any of this. It just seems like it's a hopeless mess to me, and I don't know how you ever fix it. The only thing that really drives any kind of change or reform is crisis, and otherwise it's status quo. And even in the face of all the economic and other types of crises that we've had in recent years, last decade, at the end of the day, it just seems to me that very little changes. And I have no idea what to do about it or how to change it, but sooner or later, there'll be such a big problem, it'll have to be fixed, and they'll try to fix it, and hopefully it won't be irreparable and unfixable at that time. Otherwise, I just don't see what can be done about it.
It was a couple of years ago. I watched some documentaries about Chicago. Sorry, not Chicago, Detroit. And what was going on in the inner city. Yeah, lots of people on food stamps, etc. And what I found curious about the documentaries was that they told the same story. Sure, you know, people used their food stamps at convenience stores and liquor stores, etc. But they had absolutely no way to get to a real grocery store. I mean, they, literally, people lived on hot dogs and Twinkies. I mean, how do you fix that?
Well, considering how cheap hot dogs and Twinkies are relative to so-called good food, you know, I don't know how you fix it. I don't know. Absolutely no idea.
And John, you're the guy that lives on hot dogs and Twinkies.
I was going to say, what's wrong with a balanced diet? Some Kool-Aid to wash it down.
Right. Oh, I thought you were going to say, oh, and a big gulp.
Kool-Aid's cheaper.
Oh, Lord.
So did you have a question, Simon?
No, not no. I just like to turn the microphone over to you because you always have something entertaining to say.
Oh, I have come up with an idea motivated by Sam and Peter. I was thinking, because I think this is when it's going to come down to eventually anyway, so let's just see how this works out. And as far as I know, no one suggested this yet. Let's start reprinting the Salmon P. Chase $10,000 bill, which I think has been out of existence for like 60 years. And if that doesn't work, why don't we just print 16 $1 trillion bills? We could put Obama on the front and Paul Krugman on the back and see how that works out.
Well, you could probably sell a couple of them to Vegas casinos.
Yeah, or Macau. They would probably buy it.
But Macau.
Let's see how that works out. 16 $1 trillion bills, that's a one with 12 zeros at the end. Because I think that's the only way we're going to get out of this debt crisis. They're never going to cut. I don't have any confidence in them to do the right thing because they do have a vested interest in remaining in power, and there's too many people who are going to oppose any type of what do they call it? Austerity measures. The dikes burst. There's already like 50% of people living off entitlements, and it's going to be Greece if they try to enact any austerity measures, and they won't get elected. So I really don't see any way out of it other than printing more money, which has been tried by a lot of other countries, and it's never worked. The only people who make money on that are speculators like George Soros.
Oh, no.
Well, the surest way to drive down the value of the dollar is just to print more dollars. So,
and that's what
I
we're
agree.
Doing. I think $40 billion a month, like I said. Bernanke's already committed to that for the next year. So why don't we just excel? Krugman said we didn't spend enough in the first stimulus. So that's the only way. We're never going to be, I think we only take in something like $3 trillion in revenue a year. And we're already up to $16 trillion in debt. And they're spending more than $3 trillion, so we're even coming in with more debt. So I just think of the austerity that would have to be imposed. It's not practical.
Yeah, and we'd have to change our name to Greece.
Yeah, and I mean, thanks to union regulations, the poor people can't even buy Twinkies anymore. So hopefully they can still get scooter pies.
There's always a silver lining.
Yeah, I'm an optimist, Peter.
I like it. I like it.
Okay, I'm going to throw this question out. We're past, you know, fiscal cliff number one, but there's this looming deal about spending cuts. It's, in my opinion, going to be a big food fight. Is there any way that that something meaningful is going to get passed? Sam, you're the sensible politician.
Yeah, well, thanks. I don't think, like I said, I think that, you know, right now, I'm going to look at it this way. The big thing that the Republicans had to do, you know, I think it was a strategic retreat. And what I mean by that is the big thing during the campaign was soak the rich, and Republicans don't care about people on unemployment. Well, the two things that they won on Monday, or whenever they did that fiscal cliff, was the rich at $450,000 did get the taxes to go up, and they extended unemployment benefits as a strategic retreat. And this is, you know, as I see it. So now MSNBC, CNN, Nancy Pelosi, all of, these are all John's buddies, by the way, you know, Nancy Pelosi and all these other people, they can't point the finger at Bain on Republicans and say, you guys didn't soak the rich. I mean, you didn't tax the rich. You don't want them to pay their fair share. Well, in reality, they agreed with the president and Harry Reid, another one of John's friends, and they now have, you know, that issue behind them now. The Republicans now can say, look, we raise taxes on the rich, and we agreed to, you know, we're compassionate people. We increased the unemployment benefits. Okay, so they've kind of, there was a strategic retreat on that. So now the issue becomes, okay, now what are you going to do? Now, I saw that now it's about the debt ceiling and spending, because there were no spending cuts. You know, the government went up. Obama increased the deficit incredibly, along with the Democrats and the Republicans on Monday and Tuesday. They went around for it. Taxes all went up on everybody, as we talked about, even my employees. Myself and everybody else, everybody in front of the listening audience who gets a paycheck, taxes went up. So, but there were no spending cuts to go with that. If there were, I didn't see them. And I'm not, so the next thing comes in the end of February, what are we going to do about this fiscal cliff? What are we going to do about the debt ceiling? Because according to Tim Geithner, December 31st of 2012, we ran out of money. He sent out a memo, I don't know if any of you saw that, was called during the holidays, that he said as of 12:31 midnight, the government can't pay its bills anymore. Can't pay the interest that we're going to default. Well, a lot of people didn't care, didn't see it, but right now, as John said, we're operating on this continuing resolution, little money here, little money there, and comes at the end of February, and Obama and Reid said they want a blank check for the debt ceiling. They want to Obama wants to bypass Congress for the debt ceiling. He doesn't want to
open-ended,
be able to do it for Congress. He wants it open-ended. So no president ever has to do this again. And to me, that's astonishing that he got away with it. I don't care that he won the election. I don't care that he's the second term. Presidents of the United States don't say things like that. You know, but he did, because he thinks that they can keep going on and on and on with the spending program. We're running out of money. Pretty soon, all the programs that Obama and Nancy Pelosi and Harry Reid and MSNBC and all these other people want out there for people, they're not going to exist, not because people don't want them, because the money's going to be going to pay the interest on the debt. That's going to start gobbling up everything pretty soon if we don't do anything. And we're going to have to cut defense. You know, any Republican, John, I tell you this, you're a good Republican. I know you, and you believe in a strong defense and everything, but defense has to get cut too.
There's a lot of waste, fraud, and abuse everywhere.
And it all has to be out. And until we do that, and that also means earmarks, and that also means someone told me, I didn't even know this, but if you serve one term in Congress, just say it's a 1-2-year term, like Alan West, and rightfully so, got booted, do you know he gets a lifetime pension and health care benefits? One term, 2 years.
Sam, I think he qualified because he did over 20 years in the military.
All right, that's different. I have no problem with that, John.
But he already had his pension from the military.
Yeah, okay. I don't have a problem with the military pension. He paid his time for that, whether with that. But these members of Congress, and a lot, you know, every 2 years, at least 20 to 30 of them don't get reelected or they quit or whatnot. They get lifetime pensions. You know, they wrote it in there. And let's face it, did anybody see what they tried to sneak in? Even though it was about pay ranges for all federal employees, which was caught by some people. They're all going to get raises. The president, the vice president, the members of Congress, their staff, the judiciary, and all that stuff. But that was stopped because they'll come up with another way to stick it to us on that one. But where does it stop? And I guess it's the problem is it should have stopped when it started way back when. You know, that's the problem. At some point, it graft and buying off people and it started, and no one stood up to it back then. And now it has snowballed to where we have right now, as Simon started the show off with, NASCAR getting $70 million. Isn't that the most, you know, in all due respect, Simon, you know what? If you think about it, NASCAR is a great analogy for Washington because the NASCAR drivers all wear patches that show that people are sponsoring them. Maybe it's time our politicians all start doing the same thing.
Actually, NASCAR analogy, an even better one, they just go round and round.
Those were pretty good, guys.
Yes. I guess I'll ask you guys your opinion. At the end of February, are we going to increase the debt and just keep on the status quo, going to just keep on going and there'll be a fight, or are we going to finally have a showdown to start to put this debt under, start to attack this debt, and we start to attack, we've already got tax increases. Now it's time to attack this debt, and it's time to get some spending in government and get government out of under control at all levels. Do you think that's going to happen? What do you two think?
Oh, I'm going to pass this on to John.
You know what, Simon? I'd like to hear from Peter because I'm at my best when I'm stumbling after his arguments.
Forgive me, but what exactly is the question? What do I think is going to happen with what?
Okay, the debt limit and spending cuts that are supposed to take place in February. That's the next big debate at the end of February.
Well, you know, Simon said, so we survived fiscal cut one or fiscal cliff one. We're in a perpetual state of fiscal cliff or cliffs, and we're going to be in a fiscal cliff phase, you know, for quite a while. And you might as well just divide it into any number of subsets. We've been in a fiscal cliff period before so-called fiscal cliff one. I don't know what's going to happen in February. They've postponed certain things until February. There's going to be another debate in February. A lot will depend on what the climate is in February. I suspect that they'll postpone it again, or they'll postpone parts of it. They'll keep doing this and playing this game as long as they can until they can't do it anymore. And I just really have no idea what they're going to do with all of these various limits and things. And I think we're going to be on quite a long phase here where we're constantly haggling over fiscal cliffs until somebody believes that it's really no longer an emergency and we might as well worry about something else. And then they'll come back to it. That's my honest opinion.
That's actually a very, very sensible view.
Says nothing. It says nothing, but it is sensible.
Right.
No, I mean,
we're headed for 4 more years of the same.
If we're lucky, this will last 4 years or less. If we're lucky, I fear this is the new political economy. We're going to be experiencing this kind of stuff for years to come.
Right, John. I know that you're all for democracy, but not Democrats.
I'm for a republic. I believe minority rights should be protected, not straight democracy.
Oh, right. How could this be fixed? You know, take a blank sheet of paper. What should the government do? And ignore party labels here. Just give me your ideas.
Wow, if I were suddenly made king, huh?
Yeah. You're King John for the next 5 minutes.
All right, let me first pay tribute to Peter on his last comment. A marvelous example of periphrasis or circumlocution.
I don't know what those mean.
I can explain it to you. He knows. And also, Peter, I wanted to ask you a question. You really mellowed in 2013 because the last few weeks, you've been acting like you're conducting a deposition or a cross-examination. So what happened to you?
Well, it is my profession to be a lawyer, and I guess I had a trial that was scheduled to start on December 31st, and I kept having that in my mind, so forgive me for that. I'm actually just trying to enjoy the new year, but I'm confident that my dark side will reemerge sometime in the next month or so, and I apologize in advance for it.
I appreciate your dark side.
Well, it's still there. It ain't going anywhere.
Good. So the stress is off and you're back to normal for now.
Well, I don't think I'm ever back to normal, but one trial ends and I'm scheduled to start some other crazy trial tomorrow, but I'm not particularly concerned about it. It should be pretty straightforward.
All right, Simon, if I were king for a day, I would probably not fly off to Hawaii and take a vacation. I can say that. I would try to get together with, which hasn't been done, business leaders like Bernie Marcus and Ken Langone and a lot of the people on Wall Street, and talk about job creation. Because I believe the only way we're going to get out of this, other than printing money, is create wealth. And the government can't do that, no matter how much they try. They can redistribute, but we need to talk to some people who have had success in job creation. And I'm not an expert. I'm just a small guy. But there are people who have had tremendous success. And why aren't these people networking with the politicians? There's a lot of good people out there who are willing to help, and they're just on the sideline. So I really think that's what we need to do, look to job creators and find out how they built their empires and created wealth and employed people.
For once, John, you're making absolute sense.
Yeah, that's because I said I don't have a clue, but I talk to smart people. And by the way, Simon, I consider you one of those. I probably consult you.
No, John, you're entirely right. What we need to do is generate more wealth.
Yeah.
But if you look at what's happened in the last 30, 40, 50 years, the U.S. has been in decline. We've moved out of being the kingpins of of manufacturing. And something needs to change. You know,
well, Simon, we got to incentivize job creators, not disincentivize.
Right.
Like Hollywood, you talked about earlier. That's what we need to do, but do it across the board and get some people in there with some business sense instead of academics and people who have absolutely no real-world experience. But that's not who we elect. So, I mean, a business guy like Romney is demonized. So I don't really have much hope for that, but as always, I remain sanguine.
Oh, Lord. but seriously, John, you would dump the current infrastructure and...
I agree with Ron Paul. I'd probably get rid of half of the cabinet positions, all the czars. I would cut government down to bare bones and tell those people, go make an honest living.
Okay, and I like that. You know, I think that government is way too big. But ideas that have been floated around are to get rid of various departments. FDC. FBA, I'm sorry. Would that be a good idea?
No, we certainly need some regulation in that area. I'm just saying that don't make it a bureaucracy that becomes tyrannical. That's got to have oversight, too. And the best ideas are going to come from people who volunteer their time, not paid bureaucrats.
Ah, now you've hit the magic note, volunteer. You know, suddenly, government is big business. I mentioned this a couple of weeks ago. You know, the average congressman makes $174,000 a year, but it doesn't stop there. You know, he's got another $1 million that he can use for, you know, employing staff and all the rest of the accoutrements.
Right, I think they call them franking privileges. Peter would know.
Peter, am I right?
Franking privileges?
Yeah. Isn't that what they call them?
Mailing. They can mail anything in the district for nothing.
Right. Yeah, they can mail anything anywhere.
Anywhere, I just the district.
My recollection, you know, from the late 80s was you had just unlimited postage.
I believe it.
Postage is not a huge expense. I mean, it's not that big a deal, but all you had to do was drop it in the mailbox and it went out. You know, the Postal Service took it and sent it. There was no...
Yeah, but you've
yes.
got to pay a staff to coordinate that.
Yes, that's true.
Okay, but John, right, do you think a $1 million a year budget for staff and other expenses is a good thing?
I think it's more, Simon. I think they get more. I think they have a home office and they have an office in Washington. I think it's a lot more than $1 million.
I'd be surprised if it was only $1 million.
Yes, I think it's a lot more. I think it's
okay.
a lot more.
At this point, I'm rolling my eyes. Here they are, nickeling and diming. Yeah, the poor guy that. You know, works at Burger King or whatever, and yet they're fat cats. I mean, there's something wrong here.
Oh,
John, you're not going to jump on that?
Simon, you had your chance. You voted for Obama. Now you have buyer's remorse. What do you want me to say? It's only the next 4 years, and then you'll probably support Biden or Hillary.
What? Hillary, I've got a headache. I can't appear.
I can't feel sorry for you, Simon. You got us into this mess.
Oh, that's right. Blame it all on me.
No. We have to blame somebody. But you know what's really scary? And Peter, you brought up something that, look, this is reality. This is what we're living in, this economic, political calamity of, kick the can down the road, a little spending, more taxes, raise the debt, nothing ever happened until it collapses. And then we'll have to, hopefully the right people will be there to clean up the mess. I don't know. But I was just thinking while you guys were all making your points, that when Bill Clinton left the White House in 2000, it was a balanced budget. And now, now 13 years later, with $16 trillion in debt.
Well, Sam, it was balanced for a couple years because of the balanced budget, man, but he did leave a $6 trillion deficit.
I don't think he had any deficit. It was a balanced budget.
Sam, it was either balanced or $6 trillion, six of one, half dozen of the other.
It was $6 trillion the deficit, but he did balance for a few years because of the balanced budget amendment.
Now, granted, stuff happened. 9/11. Well, I'm not gonna. There's never been times throughout history where there's been some sort of, calamity. There's wars. There's this. There's that. And all that stuff happened. But under Bush and Obama and the Democratic controlled Congress, the Republican controlled Congress, the administration, these guys just can't stop. They just can't help themselves. It's the power that comes with it. And it's destroying this country because. What effects do they really have? Peter, when you were in D.C., you're in D.C., right?
Correct.
Did you find that D.C., the people there working there all the time, were just isolated from what's really going on in America? Because my dad's buried at Arlington National Cemetery. And we go back every couple of years to visit him, visit his grave. And I'm just amazed when I go into Arlington, all those areas, those nice Georgetown, all those areas of D.C., the bars are packed, the restaurants are packed, people are all throughout the streets. There's no for sale signs, there's no vacancies. It just looks like it's a boom town. And I'm wondering, was it like that when you were there? I mean, are they that out of touch because they're in that bubble of there's nothing but good money and good jobs and good things going on there? They think the rest of the country's that way? I mean, is that a possibility?
Well, I think that D.C., when I was there from 87 to 89, and it was hustling and bustling, and it was, everything was great. And I was there when we had the first stock market crash in the 80s, and the bottom fell out. But it was hustling and bustling, but I didn't find it to be, I think every place, to a certain extent, is its own bubble. I live in L.A. or the L.A. area, and people here think about certain things that are regional specific, and they talk about it, and that's all they think about because that's part of this quote-unquote bubble. People in D.C. had their own bubble that was unique to their own region, and I think it's like that everywhere in the world. To a certain extent, you're aware of what's going on in the outside world, but to a certain extent, you're just living in your own world, wherever your world may be and whatever's going on in it. And D.C. is one of those towns where, since it is the nation's capital, it has its own built-in industry. And since it has its own built-in industry, if people coming into that town and buying goods and services and utilizing everything, it's got a sort of a self-sufficient economy in that respect. So I don't know if I found the people there to be any more or less out of touch than anywhere else in the world. I'd say it's probably, if anything, they were more in touch because most the industry there is politics, and that includes domestic relations, international relations, and that's what people talked about. Though, what do you think about this? What do you think about that? They weren't talking about movies, and they weren't talking about Wall Street. That was primarily their life.
I lived for the best part of a decade in San Diego, and everyone views the city as a vacation mecca. It certainly is. You know, some great attractions, but what underpins the entire economy is the defense industry. So many people are employed to support the Navy. You know, even down to the hot dog vendor. I mean, you know, cities have unique ways of funding themselves. So I'm sure that DC is very much like that. I mean, their industry is politics.
That was my experience. Now, again, you know, in a town like DC, I remember I had this particular image that always struck me every time I went to work. I worked in the Rayburn office building for the House of Representatives, and I would enter on one of the street levels, but, you know, it was an uneven street entrance, so I would actually enter in the sub-basement structure of the building. And when you go to the sub-basement structure of the building, you encounter this entire life force of people who are responsible for the bloodstream of the building. You know, this massive infrastructure, pipes, carts, moving trucks, moving. These people were, you know, responsible for maintaining all the life support of the building. And, these people were just hardworking people. They came to work every day, 9-to-5 jobs, punching time clocks, and keeping the lifeblood flowing. And then I would take the elevator up, and I would go to the main part of the building or the office part of the building, and the whole structure would change. And, you know, then it was this whole suit and tie crowd, and that's when I was, you know, walking past Charlie Wilson's office to go to my boss's office, and everybody was suit and ties, and everybody was carrying clipboards and looking at papers and talking about, you know, world affairs. And, you know, it just struck me this huge dichotomy. And when I say that people were aware of what was going on, and they were aware of it in a political sense because that's what their jobs provided. I think the people in the bowels of the building who are responsible for keeping it alive, keeping the furnace running, I mean, they were just working class people, and they were, you know, struggling the way all working class people are, in my opinion, to just make ends meet and survive and focus on the issues that mattered to them as far as day-to-day living. And I think it's like that everywhere to a certain extent. Everywhere you go, you see that kind of structure, in my opinion.
Okay, I'm going to switch gears completely. But there's a case that I've been following for several months. The rape in Steubenville, Ohio. Sam, that's kind of on your doorstep, but don't think I'm implicating you. Have you heard much about this case?
Oh yeah, it's a matter of fact. Steubenville plays a big part in my the second book I wrote called The Organ Grinder and the Monkey. So I'm very familiar with Steubenville, the history of it. If you don't know Dean Martin from Steubenville, his name is so was Jimmy the Greek Snyder. And also, believe it or not, one of the when I stumbled upon it, I couldn't believe it. Edwin Stanton, who was Abraham Lincoln's Secretary of War, a very powerful politician during the Civil War and afterwards, who probably gave one of the greatest quotes of all time after Lincoln was assassinated. His quote was, "Now he belongs to the ages." He's from Steubenville. Those three people, but it's a little river town, about an hour south of me. The borders are right across from West Virginia. It had a great – now, the reason I know it real well from just being part of my book is my kids went to a Catholic school called Cardinal Mooney, and we always – our big rivalry was Steubenville Big Red, and Simon, I know you've heard that. It's a big football town. Okay, Steubenville, big, and that's all that's got left. It's got the most. Some people say it's the most beautiful high school stadium in the world, and I tend to agree with that. Incredible amounts of alumni support. As the town's fortunes went down the toilet, you know, because for business, you know, there's no more coal down there. There's no more. You know, all the industry kind of went kablooey. The only thing down there is the high school. And it's a public high school. They recruit from all over. And the football team is fabulous. It's called Big Red. And they've played my son's high school team numerous times over the years for state championships and this and that. So it's quite a budding rivalry, and that's why it's figured into my book. But anyway, that aside, during the summer, these two, at least two football players, from the very good football players, allegedly raped this young girl, and then they were on a video. Simon, have you seen the video taken by the girl of the two boys talking about the rape?
Yes, I have.
Okay, that's the one that's gone viral. It's horrible. It's absolutely pathetic, and they took that down, and it split the town in two. There's those that are basically pro-football and those that want justice, and it's become a real problem down there as it's become national attention, and everyone's going down there, and you know, there's the thing of, hey, you know, they're protecting the jocks. It's about protecting the football team, et cetera, et cetera. That's part of the problem. There's the whole idea that these kids would rape a girl. She passed out and they raped her and brag about it. And people knew about it in authority, and no one did anything until some other good Samaritans, for lack of a better term, rallied behind this young woman and they wanted to see justice. I will tell you, Simon, something just happened today. The Steubenville Police Department put up a website. And you can go on to it. It's dedicated to
SteubenvilleFacts.org.
You got it. And they put that on there about trying to get what's happening. But there has been, if you go down there, from what I'm told, there's just like a cone of silence. And everyone's afraid to say something. And it's a big, small town, especially when it comes to its high school football program. And that's to me, it's pretty pathetic that the high school football is that important, and this young girl was raped, that's what's really being protected here instead of the truth. And I hope the truth comes out, and those that are punished, those that are guilty, are punished beyond, you know, are severely punished. It's the same old story we always hear, whether it's young boys, young girls, or white-collar criminals, politicians, or whatnot, the cover-up's worse than the crime. The crime was bad enough, but the cover-up that's gone over for this thing is just outrageous.
I guess what bothers me is the lack of coverage that the case got from local media in particular.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't until a civil suit was launched by some blogger, I think her name is Andrea Goddard, something like that, and suddenly, you know, this is front page news. It seemed to me that the Steubenville rape was just going to disappear quietly into the night.
Oh, I think that's what they wanted to do. I was shocked that they knew the two boys who were star football players who were involved, because this happened before the season began in August, and people wanted them suspended, and they still weren't suspended. Even the Ohio State Athletic Association found out about it. They tried to put clamps down on it, and they were straight on out of the way. I mean, it's a real powerful, powerful organization down there. Like I said, it's the only thing the town has left. I mean, parts of the town, it looks like you're like parts of Detroit. Then all of a sudden you come upon this high school and its stadium, and you would think, well, wait a minute. How can this one part of the town be so look like Berlin after World War II? And then here you have this gorgeous, and I mean gorgeous high school, and it's a beautiful high school stadium. And, you know, you're talking on Friday nights, it sits like 9,000 people. There's 9,000 people in the stands there. You know, it is a moneymaker for them. They don't want it bothered, you know, and all that, the merchandising that goes with with Big Red. It's just incredible, and that's what it, and it's what it's all about. It's about the money, not the justice. It's about the money this time. But I was thinking, illustrious friends in California, Manny sent me an email about some that weird rape case that gathered all your attention in Southern California. That was a strange story. Peter and John, you know what I'm talking about?
No, I don't know what you're talking about.
Oh, the case that was, Manny sent me the story about this, the Supreme Court. There was some woman who was raped by an old boyfriend, but because she wasn't married, there was a law on the books from like 1640 in California, and they had to toss the rape charge against the guy.
Well, that's news to me. I never heard about that, but nothing really surprises me anymore. I'd like to find out more about the facts.
John, did I hit that right, or did I not hit that right?
Not familiar with it either.
Okay, we're getting short on time. Peter, have you looked at the Steubenville case?
Yeah, I've looked at it, and you know, it reminded me of law school, because you know, one of the courses you're supposed to take your first year of law school is criminal law. And you start up progressing through all the elements of crime and what you're looking for, and everyone sort of talks and they say things, and then you remember. I'll never forget that very first day we talked about rape in criminal law school. We finally got to rape on the syllabus, and it amazes me the kind of discussions that we had that day and the things that people said, and. On top of all the factors that everyone's talked about, you know, the power of the football program and the tight-knit nature of the community and the economics that are involved, you add to that just the incredible volatility of a rape charge. It is very amazing what people's attitudes and values are regarding a rape charge, and how wildly divergent they are, and how in many respects they're very gender specific impressions, but in many respects they're what we call contra gender specific. Oftentimes, you know, rape victims are most severely chastised, not oftentimes, but sometimes by women, more so than men. And you know, it's just an incredible quandary. And when I hear about a story like this, and I see what's going on, and I see all the crazy allegations, the so-called cover-ups, and the way the victim's treated, and I just can't help but think that there's a lot more going on here, even than's being reported. And you know, it would really take someone to really immerse themselves in the culture of this community and the identities of the victim and their characters and the characters of the accused and everybody else involved. It's just never a simple situation. It's always very convoluted when it comes to rape allegations.
Okay, so Sam, there's your mission for the week.
You know, you want to go down to Steubenville and do some up for
you? Look, you know, just compare it to one situation that came to mind when I was reading about this. It was the Kobe Bryant rape trial. And what happened there, it seems to me, is that people really didn't like the victim. They just didn't like her. And there were a lot of reasons that people held up to why they didn't like her, but they just didn't. And Kobe wasn't even a native of Colorado. He was, quote-unquote, the enemy. He was the enemy from L.A., and his team actually played the Denver Nuggets in the playoffs that year while the rape trial or the rape case was proceeding. But what happened in that case, in my opinion, was that, you know, people just didn't like the victim. And without expressing any other opinion about anything else, the prosecution came to the conclusion that they couldn't go anywhere with it. And that's just one example of how a rape prosecution can be a difficult case. I have no idea what's going on at the ground level on this thing, but but there seems to be some element of that as well. Whether it's justified or not, I don't know. But it's always very complicated with these types of cases, in my opinion. I know that's not saying very much, but that's all I can think to say.
Okay, gentlemen, I have to call a close to today's excitement. But I want to go once around the table. John, I'm going to start with you, because you're the hardest to get along with.
Well, thanks, Simon. Hopefully this comment will exacerbate my condition. I'd like to talk about New Year's resolutions. I can't remember who said this, but I saw it years ago, and I would have been well served to follow these admonitions in my youth. Although, Simon, one of these rules may not apply to you because you would find it difficult to find a qualified and willing participant, but I'll leave it up to your listeners the discretion to determine which one. The first was never eat at a diner or restaurant named Mom's. The second was never play cards with someone named Doc. And the third was never, ever become intimate with someone whose problems are greater than your own. Rules to live by, Simon.
I like it. And I trust you will be coming back next week.
And I may have violated several of those provisions by then.
John, you have yourself a simply splendid week.
Take care, guys. Good talking to you.
And Sam, do you have any parting shots for us? And I suspect that Stephenville will be on the menu next week.
Yes, I did suspect that. Maybe I'll go down and be. I'll go down there and report from Steubenville as the man in the street. Would you guys like that? Questions. I'll probably get killed, but it'll be fun doing it. It's a terrible thing, but more is going to come out. The cover up. It will be. The crime is hideous, but the cover up's even worse, and that's terrible. But that's what's going to happen. And I wish it was nice to hear everybody's voices and thoughts, and Happy New Year to you all. And I hope this year is a better year for all of us and the listening audience. And stay tuned, because you're right, Simon. Fiscal Cliff 1 is going to be a sequel, the prequel to Fiscal Cliff 2, which is coming.
Okay, well, one very quick question. You really think that Steubenville's going to explode?
Oh yeah, especially when they're found guilty. I don't, Peter brought up a good point about no one liked who the victim was, and Kobe was Kobe. This one here is no one's ever seen, no one can form an opinion of her at this point, from what I understand. But what they can do is to form I think what's happening is people are forming an opinion, much as like I said, is, hey, this is all about protecting a football team and its image. Not getting the justice that it deserves. And I think that's just going to come back on them. They better be very careful with the public relations, because right now it's not. They're getting beaten up pretty bad by the Cleveland Plain Dealer, the Columbus Dispatch, and Cincinnati Inquirer, and in Ohio. That's not a good thing.
Oh, they're getting beaten up by CNN as well.
The three big news. Because people still, they're doing that. Yes, and you're right about the local media isn't that, the Steubenville, whatever it is, the Youngstown Vindicator here and this and that, they can't, the kindergarten is compared to the three newspapers I just talked about. Throwing now, it's my understanding, the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, which is an awesome newspaper, is over there now doing some investigations and, reporting, and it's going to not be pretty for those who have done stupid things.
Right. And Peter, your final thoughts.
Well, sometimes the best form of justice, or one of the best forms of justice, is just scrutinizing something and putting it under the spotlight and having everybody put your cameras on it and ask your questions and exposing everything. And oftentimes that can be the most valuable thing, and I hope that happens in Steubenville. And secondly, you know, we seem to have touched the fiscal cliff, or at least deferred it, but don't forget, we've still got an apocalypse to worry about, so we haven't quite dodged that bullet. Maybe we'll chat about that sometime.
Oh, crap. I thought we avoided the apocalypse.
No, the apocalypse is a never-ending threat.
Oh,
never-ending threat.
Another one.
No, there's always another one.
That's true. Just like there's another fiscal cliff, there's another apocalypse.
There's always another apocalypse, and in theory, a fiscal cliff is just a subset of the apocalypse. So let's address the big issue.
I don't know if this is syntactically correct. Would they be known as apocalypti?
Apocalypti. Well, that for this program, that works for me. I'll accept that definition. That word.
Gentlemen, I want to thank you for taking part today, and I'm sure we'll be back next Sunday with another episode. Until then, I want to wish everyone a happy, healthy, and safe week, and my thanks, great thanks, to my wonderful panel. Till next week, goodbye.